What's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. The Turkish Prime Minister saying the Islamic State group is behind Tuesday's suicide attack at the Istanbul airport that killed at least 36 and injured dozens more. Dorian Jones reports on the deadly attack and how it unfolded.
Turkish officials say three heavily armed suicide bombers targeted Istanbul Atatürk Airport's international terminal at mid-evening local time. According to witnesses, one of the bombers detonated his explosives outside the international arrival terminal. The two other attackers are believed to have sought to enter the terminal, which is protected by heavily armed police and X-ray machines. Airport security camera images show one of the bombers inside the terminal, armed with a pistol. He appears to fall and then detonates his explosives. Dorian Jones, Istanbul.
So far, no one has claimed responsibility for the attack, which comes as the Turkish government grapples with a dual threat of the Islamic extremists and Kurdish rebels in the southeastern part of the country. The Republican-led investigation into the terrorist attack on the U.S. outpost in Benghazi, Libya, 4 years ago that killed four Americans ended with no new allegations on the actions of then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
So while this unfortunately took on a partisan tinge, I want us to stay focused on what I've always wanted us to stay focused on, and that is the important work of diplomacy and development.
Clinton, now the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee, said it's time to move on. The U.S. Defense Department says changes have been made to improve the response of personnel based on the incident in Benghazi. This is VOA News. British Prime Minister David Cameron met with the European Union leaders in Brussels for the first time Tuesday since British voters chose to quit the EU.
But they were very constructive discussions. They were very positive. They were very calm. They were very understanding that Britain should seek and Europe should seek the closest possible relations as Britain leaves the EU.
Cameron, who says he will resign because of the Brexit vote, says he will not be involved in the process of negotiating Britain's departure from the European Union. The head of the EU Commission is urging Britain to clarify its position soon. France and other EU members fear the longer Britain waits, the more economic damage could occur. The U.S. Senate is blocking the new funding to fight Zika. The action prompted a flurry of bipartisan finger-pointing in the chamber Tuesday. Democrats banded together to defeat the $1.1 billion emergency funding bill to put together by Republicans, objecting to cost offsets inserted into the legislation, including funding cuts to abortion provided by Planned Parenthood. Democrats said the bill allocated too little money to battle Zika. One senator described it as a bill designed to fail. Republicans are warning the country is on the verge of a health crisis because of Zika. Volkswagen has agreed to a nearly $15 billion settlement of consumer and environmental claims to its emission rigging scandal that broke last September in the United States. U.S. car owners with the 2-liter diesel engines have the choice of either selling their car back to Volkswagen or getting a repair. Each customer will also receive compensation between $5,000 to $10,000. A U.S. district judge in California will hold a hearing next month to decide whether to grant a preliminary approval of the settlements. The U.S. Supreme Court has dismissed appeals from two states whose restrictions on abortion clinics were struck down by lower courts. The justices refused to hear appeals about laws in Mississippi and Wisconsin that would have required physicians who perform abortions to have admitting privileges at local hospitals. The High Court denied the appeals one day after it struck down a similar provision in the state of Texas. And a new public opinion poll shows that Americans believe Democratic presumptive presidential nominee Hillary Clinton would do a better job dealing with terrorism than Republican Donald Trump. 50% of those responding to the Washington Post ABC News poll survey say they trust Clinton to handle terrorism, compared to 39% for Trump. The latest poll results show a significant shift in public opinion since the terrorist attacks in Paris and San Bernardino, California. I'm Michael Brown reporting in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, in for James Batty. Today is Wednesday, June 29th, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you. The United Nations says a record number of people caught in conflict and natural disasters are in need of humanitarian assistance. At the same time, the world body warns that the funding response to this crisis falls far short of what is needed. Police in Zambia arrested and detained the editor of the country's largest independent newspaper, The Post.
Some agents of State House actually came to our premises and they were giving orders to the police. And when I was leaving the office, they grabbed me like a criminal, started beating me up, you know, punching me, slapping me.
Joseph Mwenda is the deputy news editor of Zambia's The Post newspaper. South Africa's treasury says that South African President Jacob Zuma has to pay back about $500,000 or 3% of the public funds used to upgrade his personal country home.
I mean, we had determined that the president owes at least 52.9 million rand on the 9th non-security upgrades. We would have loved the president to pay the entire bill of the Uganda, but the treasury has come to a determination.
Mabin Siabe is the spokesperson of the South African Opposition Democratic Alliance. Those stories, plus Marco Wuma's sports, are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Police in Zambia arrested and detained the editors of the country's largest independent newspaper, The Post. The Post was shut down last week over what the government's tax collection body says are unpaid taxes. However, the management of The Post disputes the sum of $4.8 million, saying that the closure has more to do with the ruling party trying to muzzle the press a few months before elections. Those arrested yesterday include the Post news editor Fred Mbembe, his wife Mutinta, together with the deputy news editor Joseph Mwenda. I reached Mr. Joseph Mwenda in Lusaka, where he recounts the events that led to their arrest.
We got a stay, right, from the Revenue Appeals Tribunal, restraining the Zambia Revenue Authority from continuing the seizure of our property. When we got that stay, we went to the ZRIA people and served it on them, and they signed, acknowledging that they've received it. And we communicated to them that we were going to go ahead to serve the same stay on the police officers who were, in control of our head office, the editorial office. So when we served that stay on the police officers, then they said that they needed to consult with the command. Meanwhile, the ZRA officer whom we asked to also communicate with the police officers to give us access to the premises also said he was going to, communicate with his superiors and reach a compromise that allow us to go back and start working. But then, somewhere along the way, the decision was made that we shouldn't, be allowed to gain access.
Who made that decision?
We have no idea, because what happens is the ZRA people said when we called the gentleman who signed after receiving the injunction that we obtained, he said that I can't tell the police officers to open the gate first. I have to call my superiors. I'll get back to you. That was his response. But the police officers, they also said, well, we haven't been told to allow you to come in.
So you had the injunction to stay, but you were still arrested. Did they charge you with anything?
Now, what happened is that we went into the premises because we had that injunction. So we went into the premises, but that was the point now when the police officers informed their superiors that these people have, gotten inside the offices. I personally, drove in and parked my vehicle and went into my office. And the other people who had were also present, at the other employees who were present at the office time, also managed to have access to the premises. Some of them even left.
Do you feel that the policemen were getting orders from somewhere above the Revenue Authority?
Yes, the police officers were actually getting instructions straight from State House. We can prove that, and we've reported that as a matter of fact. The police officers were getting instructions from State House, and some agents of State House actually came to our premises and they were giving orders to the police. Okay? They came, switched off the offices, commanded me to leave, And when I was leaving the office, they grabbed me like a criminal, like the worst criminal you can ever think of, started beating me up, you know, punching me, slapping me, dragged me to the, you know, to the tarmac. And when the editor-in-chief tried to reason to the police, you cannot be beating a human being like this. They started beating him as well, dragged him, together with me. When the editor-in-chief's wife complained, you cannot be treating people like this, they beat her and also put her together with the two of us and started dragging, you know, the three of us away, sat us down. That was the picture that you probably may have seen, which is now circulating in Zambia, of us in the middle of the tarmac, all right, after we had been beaten. And later on, these, you know, PF cadres, whom we have actually identified, who are giving instructions to the police, and we have reported this in the story that is coming out in tomorrow's edition, they were actually giving instructions to the police to beat us as much as they could. They dragged us to the police station without any charge at all and detained us.
How long did they detain you?
We were at the police station from 11:30 p.m. somewhere there up to about 5 p.m. the following day. We spent the night at the police, and later on, after we were released, we actually showed them. I have bruises on my back and scars, and my eye socket is, you know, swollen. My lower jaw felt like it was dislocated. We complained, can we be allowed to go to the hospital? They couldn't allow us.
Now, President Lungu recently defended the shutting down or the closure of your newspaper, saying that the timing, as has been said, has nothing to do with the elections, with the upcoming elections in August. Is that something that you believe, that there's no connection between the closure of your newspaper and the upcoming elections in August?
I think that's prejudicial. What that statement was practically saying was, you know, encouraging the people in the judiciary who are handling this case to proceed in that manner. And you cannot say the judiciary is going to act independently when the president has already given a judgment.
Joseph Mwenda is the deputy news editor of Zambia's The Post newspaper. I reached him at his home in the capital, Lusaka. The arrest of journalists and shutdown of The Post newspaper has been of concern to various international media and democracy watchdogs who have condemned Zambian authorities' closure of The Post newspaper. Their concern, as echoed by U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Linda Thomas-Greenfield, is that the Zambian ruling party under President Edgar Lungu is going after the only independent media outlets that are giving balanced political coverage a few months before voters go to the polls. Jeffrey Smith is the executive director of the Vanguard Africa Movement, an organization working to advance good governance and reform across Africa. He says that the closure of The Post should not be seen as an isolated issue in the Zambian government's attempts to roll back some of the democratic changes that the country has seen in the past years.
It's really interesting because I think the very evident media crackdown that has taken place in Zambia would certainly be concerning on its own. However, there are other forces and damaging factors also at play in the country. I think even a cursory overview of the prevailing environment in Zambia would and should raise our collective concerns. I think including the thousands of foreign nationals that have allegedly been added to the electoral register, the proliferation of blank voter registration cards issued by the government, recent legislative changes that provide immunity from prosecution for electoral commission officers suspected of wrongdoing, the hostile rhetoric that we've seen increasing and the dog whistle threats being made by President Lungu to, quote, sort out the opposition, as well as the increasing violence and brutality being inflicted overwhelmingly on the opposition UPND that we have seen in the country, which is very concerning given the fact that Zambia does not necessarily have an established tradition of political violence at the polls. So I think that latter point is very concerning.
Do you feel that this fits in the general pattern on the continent in terms of reversing some of the gains that have made by going after the press?
Absolutely. I think, you know, it's really important to know, first and foremost, you know, on this topic, to sort of balance the wholly negative that has been taking place with the positive. I think the one positive instance we have here is the fact that Zambia, what many people may not know, is the only country in SADC, in the Southern African Development Community, that has twice achieved a peaceful and democratic transfer of power to an opposition party since independence. And in fact, Zambia is only one of four countries in the region to ever experience a transition of power at all, the others being Lesotho, Malawi, and the democratic standard bearer in the region, Mauritius. But to this point, you know, the concerning events that we've been discussing really should be raising our collective concern. And the key issue here is that Zambians as a people deserve a free, fair, transparent, and credible election. And if the current conditions prevail and are left unaddressed, any hope or semblance of that outcome is lost. And I think for too long, and increasingly so, the world, and most notably the African Union, has accepted that so-called peaceful elections that are somehow acceptable, and they are not. This is a fundamentally flawed logic, and it fails to understand that by lowering the democratic threshold, we thereby permit undemocratic leaders, as some would argue President Edgar Lungu of Zambia is one, and allows their corrupt regimes to flourish and provides additional incentive for others to do the same and follow in their path. And that's why I think it's so important for SADC in particular, and of course the African Union, if there is political will there, and other shareholders in Zambia's future, in the region's future, to really take a proactive stance on this, to send a pre-election assessment team, and to really get out in front of this issue and no longer allow this blatant rigging of an election, or otherwise tilting the electoral playing field clearly in favor of one side, and namely the incumbents.
Jeffrey Smith is the executive director of the Vanguard Africa Movement, an organization working to advance good governance and reform across Africa. I reached him at his offices in Washington, D.C. The Speaker of Liberia's House of Representatives, Alex Tyler, says President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf does not want him as Speaker in order to achieve personal political objectives. Speaker Tyler is one of those indicted because of his alleged role in a corruption scandal. A recent report by London-based Global Witness alleges that Speaker Tyler and other lawmakers were paid certain amounts by the UK-based Sabo Mining for the lawmakers to change Liberia's mining laws so the company could get the mining rights. Speaker tells VOA's James Batty, who is on assignment in Liberia, that the president has been encouraging other members of parliament to get him to recuse himself while his court case is going on.
I'm quite sure you have followed this Global Witness report and the reaction from the executive and all of the other things that are attending circumstances and situations that have been going on in this house. One can safely see the involvement of the executive in interfering in the affairs of the House of Representatives and the legislature, which you think is unconstitutional. The president cannot be doing that.
Do you really believe that the president is interfering?
Not only that I believe, I know, because the president has spoken with some of our colleagues, and she told them she wanted me out. Wanting me out means a lot to me. It could mean to get me as Speaker, it could be a threat to my person, to my life. Because those are exact words that she wanted me out.
Let me understand, Mr. Speaker, why would the president want to get rid of you?
James, you are Liberian yourself. You know this country has come a long way to reach where we are. And we thought we're at the point where democracy would be the hallmark of what we do politically, but that seemed not to be the case. This president, who all of us know was an advocate, stood up against every administration in this country. Doesn't want anybody set up to her. Everything she says should be yes. What she wants, she gets. That's the kind of leadership style that's in her. She doesn't want nobody to question her. She doesn't want the legislature to question her. In fact, in her mind, she thinks we are all boys. And Liberia has passed that stage. We're not going to succumb to that kind of leadership. I remember her saying when she took over that her taking over was the end to imperial presidency. And I see it's crawling right back, coming back from the past. And I think we need to discourage that.
Is it true that the House was considering, impeachment? Or what do you say about the president? That something she did that the House does not like?
As far as I know, nobody came to me with anything about impeachment. If you don't mind, I can give you a very brief background of how the whole thing started. Global Witness came out with a report in which it's alleged that Alex Tyler, together with some people named in the report, received bribe to change a particular law, the public procurement concession law. And we thought that the first thing that is encouraged the constitutional is coordination. When the reporter received, the only thing we heard was the president has set up a tax force. And the next thing was that we should submit to the tax force, and we disagree with that. Because we felt and we know that that particular tax force, the setting of that tax force to investigate member of other branches or other branch of government, in this case the legislature, was unconstitutional, and we thought the best thing to do was to go to court. So we encourage them. If you think we've done something wrong or if you think there was misconduct on our part, go to court, and which the president has done. And we are in court. If we are in court, then you have to wait for the court process, which we submitted to. In the face of us being in court, the president has started several steps first. People from the executive and her surrogates call for my recusal. Our law is clear. An accused is presumed innocent until proven guilty. You did an indictment. It's before the court. Then you say, I should recuse myself.
And do you think those people calling for you to recuse yourself are being supported by the president?
I would think so because of a little move. I have waited since 1 month. This country is a common law country. You can go and obtain an indictment. Then you say, I should wait for you. You go all around the world to look for evidence. I think that's wishing. That is persecution. That's not prosecution.
South Africa's Treasury has determined that President Jacob Zuma must pay back about $500,000 or 3% of the public funds used to upgrade his personal country home. The nation's highest court has accepted the report, but the president's critics say that they are still not happy. VOA's Anita Powell has this report.
Once South Africa's Constitutional Court finalizes its Tuesday ruling, President Jacob Zuma will have 45 days to pay back the money, about $500,000 of it, into the nation's coffers. South Africa's Treasury found that that's what he owes for upgrades he made to his rural homestead, called Nkandla. In 2014, the nation's top anti-corruption czar determined that Zuma benefited unduly by using 246 million rand, at the time worth about $23 million, of government money to upgrade his home. Zuma's camp said the improvements were necessary security measures befitting a head of state. Public protector Thuli Madonsela disagreed, saying the president should not have used public funds for the swimming pool, cattle enclosure, chicken run, amphitheater, and visitor center. Her report said he might have to pay back about 10 million rand. This is not President Zuma's only brush with corruption allegations. In 2007, he faced a court case over 783 charges of fraud, corruption, and racketeering over an arms deal. The court dropped the charges in 2009, clearing the path for his election. The case was revived this year, and Zuma may eventually have to appear in court over those charges. Predictably, the corruption allegations have become politicized, with the opposition Democratic Alliance insisting that his alleged pattern of corrupt activities is grounds for removal. The far-left Economic Freedom Fighters has repeatedly disrupted parliamentary sessions by demanding that he pay back the money. In April, the opposition mounted a failed impeachment challenge in Parliament over the home upgrades. The measure was easily defeated by Zuma's African National Congress Party, which holds a wide majority. DA spokesman Mabina Siabe says his party will continue to pursue other corruption allegations against Zuma. He also said the party didn't think the Treasury's bill was enough.
Well, as a Democratic Alliance, I mean, we had determined that the president owes at least 52.9 million rand on the non-security upgrades. We would have loved the president to pay the entire bill up from Gunza, but the Treasury has come to a determination.
But 7.8 million rand can still buy quite a lot in today's South Africa, which is one of the most unequal countries in the world. 7.8 million rand is just under three times Zuma's annual presidential salary. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The United Nations says a record number of people caught in conflict and natural disasters are in need of humanitarian assistance. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva. The UN warns the funding response to the crisis falls far short of what is needed.
The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs has just released the 2016 mid-year global humanitarian overview, which says the situation is very worrisome. Archer reports the number of people worldwide in need of humanitarian assistance has soared to a record-breaking 130 million. nearly 44 million more than when the United Nations launched its annual multi-billion dollar appeal in December. At the same time, it says funding requirements have increased by $2 billion to $21.6 billion, a sum needed to assist more than 95 million of the world's most vulnerable people. But it notes only $5.5 billion has been received. OCHA's spokesman Jens Laerke tells VOA about 80% of humanitarian action goes to people affected by conflict.
There's no doubt that these protracted conflicts, and I mentioned some of them, Central African Republic, Syria, South Sudan, they cost a lot of money. They are very expensive, not only because they touch upon a large number of people, but also because delivering aid in such circumstances is very expensive because of the insecurity and all the measures that need to be taken to mitigate against that.
Laerke says unprecedented global forced displacement also is stretching the ability of humanitarian organizations and donors. A recent report by the UN Refugee Agency finds 65 million people are either refugees or internally displaced. The United Nations reports victims of natural disasters also account for the rise in those needing international help. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And now time for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Wuma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, Jackson. In our Daybreak Africa Sports news, we begin with football. Ivory Coast's ASEC Mimosa pipped their Egyptian hosts El Ahly 2-1 in an Orange Africa Champions League tie in Alexandria on Tuesday night. Elsewhere in Orange Africa Confederations Cup action, the visiting Democratic Republic of Congo's TP Mazembe pipped Young Africans of Tanzania 1-0 in Dar es Salaam as Morocco's Kaukab Marrakech edged Libya's El Ahly Tripoli 2-1. Today, Wednesday, in African Confederations Cup action, Tunisian defending champions Etoile du Sahel host Morocco's FUS Rabat in Sousse as Ghana's Mediama welcome Algeria's Mouloudia Bejaia to Sekondi. In the Champions League matches, South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns engage Nigeria's Enyimba in Tswane, and Morocco's Wydad Casablanca welcome Zambia's Zesco United in Rabat. In Algeria, Serbian tactician Milovan Rajevac is the new coach for Algeria's national team, the Desert Fox, the Algeria Football Federation disclosed in Algiers. Rajevac's main task is to qualify Algeria for the 2018 FIFA World Cup in Russia, the Algerian Football Federation announced on their official website. The Desert Fox are drawn in Group B of the Africa World Cup qualifiers with Cameroon, Nigeria, and Zambia. Only the group winners advance to the World Cup. Rajevac is best remembered in Africa for guiding Ghana's Black Stars to their memorable performance at the 2010 FIFA World Cup in South Africa. Turning to golf, Zambian Aaron Simfukwe won the men's Division A contest at the Fintuk Laga Africa Jacket Amateur Golf Tournament in the Namibian capital over the weekend. Swaziland's Sifiso Vilani was runner-up ahead of Zimbabwe's Tonderai Masunga. South African Gillian Hammond won the inaugural women's contest. Botswana's Maleboho Morebodi was runner-up, with Milas Mulunga of Zambia placed third. The tournament featured top amateur golfers from Botswana, Kenya, Mauritius, Seychelles, South Africa, Swaziland, Tanzania, Uganda, Zambia, Zimbabwe, and hosts Namibia. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Eteguini, South Africa. Back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark, and have a good day. And that's it for this Wednesday, June 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, as well as sports editor Marco Wuma, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington saying, have a nice day, Africa.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.